Carolyn Dorman and Allegan State in Freezing. Maryland King for the Thomas State in Stern.
You may proceed. Ms. Tate, you're the first lawyer I've ever seen bring a pad to the podium. You ought to be on the front page of Lawyers Weekly.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
All right. Hope it works.
It does. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mary Lynn Tate. I have the pleasure of representing the appellants in this product's liability case. The case is about a defective product, a product that breaches its warranty of merchantability. It's a residential gas water heater that caused carbon monoxide poisoning of five college sophomores. We come here having been on the receiving end of the defendant's verdict for State Industries. However, that verdict was tainted by at least three legal errors. And now I want to begin with the issue that I believe is probably foremost in your minds this morning, and that is what happened at the trial and how did we get an order inconsistent with what happened at the trial. The issue is the absence of prior incidents or injuries resulting from similar gas water heaters. Now, the sequence and the chronology will make clear that the absence of prior injuries was an issue that was initiated by the motion in limine, seeking an order excluding any argument, briefing, testimony, etc., that the absence of prior incidents and the numbers, the raw numbers of the heater for similar products could not be used because that evidence was inadmissible because it was irrelevant as a matter of law.
May I interrupt you with this question?
Yes, Justice Kelsey.
Where exactly in the record did a witness, not a lawyer, but a witness, specifically testify as to the specific safety records and data with respect to past incidents?
There is no reference in the testimony to safety records. There are numerous references to the safety of this heater, the numbers that have been in use since the 1800s, and the absence of incidents.
Well, what I'm getting at is the figure that there's 60 million out there, if that's different from obviously, and 20% of those failed, or 30% of those failed, or 100% of them have never failed. And I keep looking through the transcript looking for an expert to say what you are criticizing. I question really whether that is not admissible anyway, but putting that aside for the purpose of my question. And what I see is attorneys, particularly in closing argument, building upon that, no objection made, but that's not evidence. The question in my mind is, are you, you know, tilting at a windmill here? Where is the wrong that you claim is wrong on this one point?
The wrong is in multiple witnesses' testimony, including experts Eberhardt and Adams. They both testified in several different ways that these heaters were safe if installed properly.
Well, that's why they're there. They're defending their product.
But in the end, they linked the safety representations to the 60 million in use. And that's clear in Mr. Keel's closing argument in several places.
Okay, I got that because I've read with the argument. Your point's great if there had been an objection to the argument, in which case a curative instruction would have been given and mooted it. But where is the link that you saw in closing argument in the testimony of the experts?
The testimony is in the testimony of Mr. Adams. On page 850 and 851, he is asked the question about usage. Are you familiar with usage? And he goes on to recount that there are over 60 million gas water heaters. Mind you, it's an erroneous number because he agrees later that those numbers, that number includes all the other gas heater models that are sealed exhaust.
I see that at 850 and 851, but
yes,
I don't see the second half, which is, yeah, and not one of them has ever failed.
Well, let's go back to the specific case, because here we do have testimony from Eberhardt and opening statements from Mr. Keel, where Mr. Keel says that it's been 8 years in this apartment, and in 8 years there have been no incidents. That's a clear indication of the absence of prior incidents.
That has nothing to do with 60 million units across the United States.
I believe it does, because they argue the two in conjunction. They argue that here, 8 years, no incidents. That's a clear violation of the exclusion rule in NCB and Goins and Wendy's. And in addition, Eberhardt says the same thing. It sat there for 8 years, and what happened? What happened? He says the carpet happened. But in addition,
isn't there a conceptual difference between absence of injury in a premises liability case, which are the cases you cite, and in a products liability case, where a plaintiff, I mean, it might be able to point to all kinds of other injuries as evidence of notice and of defect, and conversely, the manufacturer would come back and say, No, this is a safe product. This was a really outlier incident. So what's your response to the argument that there's a distinction between the premises liability cases and products liability cases?
Justice, I don't think the difference is between the type of case. I think it's the type of evidence. So on the one hand, if you have a claim that we had no notice that this was a problem, then those similar incidences would be evidence that the plaintiff would theoretically introduce to show that there was knowledge. This is the flip side of that. This is the defense arguing the absence of prior incidences. And our case law for over a century has said that the absence of a prior incident in a premises case, and no reason to keep that out of a products case. We have two circuit court opinions conflicting on that point at this juncture.
We don't have 100 years of law saying that in products liability design defect cases, you cannot bring in evidence of how the design operates in other circumstances. If half of these 60 million failed because of a design defect, wouldn't the plaintiff be able to bring that in and say, obviously it's unreasonably designed because half of them failed when you put them out in the market? Why wouldn't it be entirely reasonable for you to have presented that evidence, if there had been it, and for the defense to present whatever evidence they have with respect to design, not with respect to premises liability or negligence?
Yes, Justice Kelsey, there is 100 years of law with respect to the absence of prior incidences. Incidents must be excluded in this type of case. There's no reason to distinguish the product from the premises case unless there's a notice issue, unless the plaintiff wanted to prove that the defendant had notice of this.
Well, merchantability is passing without objection in the trade, and there's dozens and dozens and dozens of cases across the United States in products liability saying you do prove that by proving the trade and proving the product, and it's passing in the trade without objection, meaning it's not, it doesn't have inherent design flaws that are constantly being triggered. So I recoil a little bit with the assertion in brief and today that there's 100 years of precedent on this point when I couldn't find a single case applying it to a product liability design case in Virginia.
There's no reason to think that the Virginia rule would not apply to a product liability case, in our view, because the same issues are present. The evidence is irrelevant because it's not probative of any issue in the case and therefore inadmissible because it doesn't prove anything. It's a diversion. But in this case,
it's not relevant to design?
No. The design issue is the specific product. And in this case, these defendants state, argued that usage, which, as Your Honor correctly notes, is what are the standards, practices, customs in the industry. They were permitted to argue usage by proof of numbers, raw numbers, the 60 million number. And the market side has never been admissible in Virginia. In fact, it invites a new consumer expectations test, which is not the law in Virginia and has never been. So the judge, the court specifically said, I will permit prior incidences by Atmos and State based on custom and usage in design, which is not a concept that has ever been enunciated in Virginia law. In fact, it's
while he said that, counsel, he never really actually allowed that evidence in, did he? I understand he said that at the motion in limine, but the evidence that came in was the number of the raw number of these units in commerce or in circulation.
He did allow that evidence in, Justice Powell, from Mr. Adams on page 850 and 851, and I objected. And the question from Mr. Keel was, are you familiar and have knowledge of the usage of this in the industry? I objected on that page and said, Your Honor, that goes against the absence issue we've been discussing, and I want to preserve my objection. The objections were preserved, motion in limine, pretrial argument, during the trial, post-trial motions, post-trial argument.
Are you drawing a distinction between absence of prior injury incidences and numbers of units sold, used?
I believe there is a distinction, but in this case, the defendant conflated the two in an effort to tell the court this is admissible to prove an absence of a design defect. The raw numbers are not admissible. They're not probative. They don't say anything about the design of this specific residential heater. I also want to mention before I sit down that instruction number 22 is a definition, a bad definition, not an instruction. We objected. Not only did we object during the conference, but we objected in our pretrial papers. We gave the judge our memo on what the instruction, the elements of superseding clause, why it should be rejected in this particular case, because the content was deficient and there was insufficient evidence.
Let's look at the insufficient evidence, because I have a feeling that's going to be an issue with the other side as well. You say the instruction should not have been given because there was insufficient evidence for a superseding causation. Let me hear from that. What was defective about it?
There was insufficient evidence because in order to be entitled to that superseding cause instruction, as is enunciated in Williams versus Lee, that evidence must totally exonerate this defendant and make the sole cause on another defendant. They couldn't do that here. There were five or so issues that were enunciated as violations or maintenance
issues. It's not exoneration of the negligence of the defendant. The whole point of superseding cause is you presuppose there's negligence and you can get the superseding cause.
I beg your pardon, Justice Kelsey. You are right. It exonerates the conduct of the defendant. We haven't gotten to the issue of whether that conduct is negligence. But the instruction doesn't cover that. The instruction doesn't cover burden of proof. The plaintiff had no burden to fix the instruction. The plaintiff laid out everything in its pretrial motion with respect to what superseding cause is and should be, objected during the conference, and in argument prior to the trial also argued that burden of proof was not here.
To the extent that the instruction that they offered did not have a burden of proof within it, and the burden of proof that was offered didn't go to the superseding, where does the fault, if you will, lie that no one offered a different burden of proof instruction on the superseding? Not the plaintiff, not the defendant, and no one mentioned it during the discussion on jury instruction.
During the discussion before the case, I mentioned burden of proof. I also offered it as my memo during the instruction conference. It's all laid out there, but it's the burden on the offering party. The case law we cite here says that the offering party must offer accurate and complete instructions to cover their theory of the case, and they did not. With that, may I reserve my remaining 1 minute and 15 seconds
yes.
for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
yes.
you.
Please the court. My name is David Sturm, and I introduce Jim Keel, who will be arguing on behalf of Appley State Industries, Inc. Thank you.
And you are admitted in what state?
New Jersey, Your Honor.
All right. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
appreciate the opportunity to address the court this morning. May it please the court, my name is James Keel. I represent State Industries in connection with this matter. I'd like to highlight what I believe is some confusion between the issues raised on appeal and what actually transpired at the time of trial. I think it's very critical for us to focus on what the court actually ruled and what the court did not rule, what evidence was offered and what evidence was not offered. I request the court's permission to just outline my position with respect to the three assignments of error at the outset before I go into each of them in greater detail. With respect to assignment of error number one, it's critical to address 4 points. The court never ruled that the absence of prior incidents involving the 60 million water heaters in use was permissible. Second, state never offered evidence to suggest that the 60 million water heaters in use were not the subject of prior incidents. The evidence on the raw numbers of units in use was admissible both on the issue of custom and usage as well as to refute the elements of the breach of implied warranty claim. And lastly, the history of the water heater at use in the subject apartment during the 8 years preceding this incident was admissible on the issue of proximate cause and proximate cause alone. With respect to the remaining two assignments of error, I believe that there are 3 points that need to be addressed. The trial court did not err in abusing his discretion to admit the evidence initially on superseding negligence of others. Secondly, the court did not abuse his discretion in making a determination that there is more than a scintilla of evidence to support giving the instruction to the jury. And lastly, the statement or the charge that was given on superseding was an accurate statement of law.
Well, now, I don't want to misstate the appellant's position, but I think it's this, and I'd like for you to respond. I think the appellant recognizes that if the defendant was not negligent, the case over. Case is over right there. But if the jury found that the defendant was negligent, then the question was there a superseding cause that caused the injuries in this case and would relieve the defendant of liability? I understand that position to be that the defendant stipulated that the carbon monoxide came from the unit. There's no question about that. And unless there was another actor that completely eliminated the responsibility, legal responsibility of that defendant, unless there was evidence of that, you cannot have a superseding negligence instruction. I think that's a correct statement of the law, but the question was the evidence there to support the giving of the instruction. Can you address that?
I will. Thank you. Your Honor, the plaintiff's entire argument challenging the admissibility of the evidence is based upon the argument that the water heater was the source of the carbon monoxide that seeped into this apartment. The issue has to focus on whether or not it was the cause. Simply because it was the source does not mean that it is the cause. And there is a distinction with the difference that is very important to note in that respect. In Logan versus Montgomery Ward, this gas appliance that exploded in that case exploded, but the court said simply because it exploded did not mean that there is a finding of negligence. There needs to be a finding of cause. And throughout this case, there was numerous pieces of evidence that went into the trial that explained what the cause was for the carbon monoxide. It was not just because the water heater was the source did not mean it was the cause. The cause was the fact it was installed, a gas-fired appliance was installed in an apartment that was designed for electric water heaters. The gas-fired appliance was not maintained for 8 years. It was the lack of maintenance that caused the temperature and pressure valve to release prematurely and discharge 4,500 gallons of water over the course of 3 days at a rate far exceeding what is expected for use. 1,500 gallons of water per day as opposed to the expected use of 30 gallons per day.
But if the jury had found that this was a defective product because it shouldn't have been installed in the first place, wouldn't it be a cause?
It jury made that determination that it was a defective product, it would be considered a cost.
So if we get over that hurdle, and that certainly was possible, we get over that hurdle, then the question is there another cause that entirely supersedes the cause of your defendant, your client? It seems that's where we are now. Is the evidence lacking there?
No, the evidence, respectfully, is not lacking there, Your Honor. What the plaintiffs have argued throughout is in challenging whether or not Judge Stout abused his discretion in giving the charge was the wrong standard. The plaintiffs have argued that State didn't present sufficient evidence to warrant giving the instruction because State had to prove it was not negligent in the slightest degree in order to be entitled to the charge. That's not what the standard is. The standard is whether or not reasonable minds could differ over the issue of whether or not the intervening acts of others so entirely cut the chain between one party's negligence and the cause of the plaintiff's injuries. It's a different standard.
Well, let's pause there for just a minute. We keep talking about the primary predicate cause being the creation of the carbon monoxide. I question really whether that's the right way to put it. The cause of the accident and the injuries is not that carbon monoxide was created, but it wasn't vented the way the machine was designed to vent it. And your argument was there's more than a scintilla of evidence that the reason it didn't get vented out because it was improperly installed and improperly maintained. So tell me if I'm right or wrong. The only issue on this subject is there more than a scintilla? Not whether we believe it, agree with it, or whether we vote for it if we're on the jury. Is there more than a scintilla that the allegedly improper maintenance and improper installation of an otherwise safe design is a superseding cause? Am I right, or am I misunderstanding what you're saying?
You are right. And there was more than a scintilla of evidence to justify giving that charge in the facts of this case, in the context of this case.
What about the burden of proof issue in the wording of the instruction itself?
The binding instruction that was given, not the superseding instruction, was the exact instruction that was provided by plaintiff's counsel to the court during the charge conference. Any question about the burden of proof being improper has been waived, I respectfully submit, because it was not given by the plaintiff in connection with the charge that was ultimately given. The charge itself, the superseding negligence charge, is right from the Virginia Model Jury Charge. It is a charge that has been repeated throughout a number of cases as the exact definition.
The fact that the Model Jury Committee came up with an instruction isn't going to be dispositive. Because we've said from time to time that those were wrong. So if it's wrong, it's wrong, and it's our duty to correct it. So the mere fact that it comes from those books doesn't clinch the argument.
I submit to your Honor that the charge is not an inaccurate statement of law. It says exactly what the requirements are for a finding of superseding negligence. And the finding charge makes it perfectly clear who has the burden of proof in the case. So you have to look at
them in conjunction.
You have to look at them in conjunction. I would respectfully submit. I would also respectfully submit that during the early portion of this case, when the court was discussing superseding negligence, plaintiff's counsel, and I would ask the court to refer to joint appendix at 354 as well as 962, the definition of superseding cause that was provided by plaintiff's counsel during the in limine stage of this trial is the exact wording of the charge that the court ultimately gave to this jury. So it is troubling that the charge that was given to the jury is being challenged on this appeal when it mimics the exact wording provided by plaintiff's counsel to Judge Stout during this trial defining what superseding negligence is. The decision to give the charge is really governed by the Williams v. Lee case, where the court said if evidence is sufficient and properly given, if reasonable minds could conclude from the evidence and the reasonable inferences. The evidence in this case was there, and I respectfully submit that Judge Stout's decision to give that charge is entitled to deference, because there is no evidence that, or no suggestion that he abused his discretion in giving that charge.
Counsel, may I go back to the burden of proof instruction? As I understand the appellant's argument, their argument is that the burden of proof is on the defendant asserting a superseding cause to prove he is free of negligence. And so, as I understand her argument, they're saying that there should have been another burden of proof instruction in addition to the one that was given that made it clear to the jury whose burden of proof it was on the superseding cause issue. Is that what you understand the argument to be?
That's what I understand the argument to be, Your Honor.
And am I correct that there was no instruction that gave the burden of proof with regard to superseding cause?
There was no instruction given, and there was no instruction requested, Your Honor.
And as I further understand her argument, she's saying, I made the request when I filed that motion in limine.
I understand the motion in limine raised a number of issues, Your Honor, but it was never captured in the format of a submission to Judge Stout that said this charge needs to be given because the model jury charge is wrong or the finding instruction is wrong. So raising the argument early on about the appropriateness of even letting in evidence of superseding negligence is not sufficient to capture an objection to the charge at the end of the trial of this case.
We see this from time to time, particularly the trial lawyers see this. Someone objects to an instruction. They go, you shouldn't give that instruction at all. But they never say, but if you're going to give it, it's also wrong, and you need to restate this sentence or that sentence. A trial judge is not going to go to the second step if no one's asking him or her to do that.
And the trial judge was not requested in this case to do that, Your Honor. And in terms of preserving issues for appeal, I submit that that needs to be done. That you need to give the trial judge an opportunity to address the issue as opposed to waiting until an issue on appeal and raising it, saying I may not have raised it, but it's an appeal that warrants reversing a jury verdict and final judgment that was entered after a 9-day trial.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? This has to do with when you would offer superseding instruction and when you might not. Is there any time that you would challenge that the proximate cause was not the defendant's negligence, but in fact somebody else's negligence? Would that, by definition, be a superseding cause? Or can you have a situation where it's not a superseding cause? In other words, you're saying, yes, we may have been, first of all, we were negligent. You don't believe me and you think we were negligent. We didn't cause the injury. Something else caused the injury. Is that by definition a superseding cause or not?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It is a superseding cause if the evidence is at trial presented to the jury that one party's negligence could exist, but that party's negligence in not the slightest way contributed to the plaintiff's injuries. There's a difference between superseding and concurrent.
Well, I understand that. But I was not talking about a concurrent causation. I was talking about a sole causation. In other words, you're saying, yes, we may have been negligent. It was a negligent design. But for some reason, there was no connection between our negligent design and the injury. The connection was really between something else and the injury. Is that by definition a superseding cause?
That's by definition. If I'm following the court's question, that is by definition a superseding cause.
Because I thought a superseding cause was more in the nature of another negligence supersede or supplants, I guess, the negligence that you did. It comes in between it. It completely disconnects it.
And I apologize because I thought that's what your question was presupposed.
Yeah, I guess maybe it does. If there was no causation between your negligence, then there wouldn't be superseding because there would be no causation.
Let me read this because this is from the Lee case that, interestingly enough, both of you rely on. A superseding cause is an independent event not reasonably foreseeable that completely breaks the connection between the defendant's negligent act and the alleged injury or death. A superseding cause breaks the chain of events so that the defendant's original negligent act is not a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injury in the slightest degree, which is what I think Justice Millett is getting at. If you agree a jury could find that there was a negligence on the part of the defendant, and that that negligence somehow was a part of the release of gas that was an effective agent in causing the injuries, that whatever the superseding cause is, it has to relieve the original negligent act such that there's not even the slightest degree of responsibility. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but that's what I was asking about at the outset. How do you deal with that?
Deal with that, Your Honor, by looking at the facts of the case. And first, there has to be a finding that State and its water heater was negligently designed.
Right. We're beyond that.
Was a cause.
Yeah, what you're saying was a cause.
Was a cause.
Right.
And then
I agree with that
cause was so, had not the slightest impact upon the plaintiff's ultimate injury.
But see, I guess that's where my dilemma is. If the jury found it was a cause, and they could, I don't know what they did, but they could, then it is a cause of the release of carbon monoxide, and carbon monoxide caused the injuries. Right? So there's a sort of an unbroken chain of events. In order to get a superseding causation instruction, it seems to me you have to eliminate that cause in altogether, and I don't know in this case how you could ever do that.
Because, Your Honor, because the presumption that the water heater was the cause didn't exist in this case, just like it didn't exist in the Logan versus Montgomery Ward case. So there was no finding that it was the cause. The court never made a determination as a matter of law that water heater...
No, the court doesn't do that. The jury does it.
Correct.
And there's no interrogatories to this jury.
Correct.
As a result, what we have is instructions, and they could reach this conclusion. And if the conclusion is that your client was negligent, and the source of the carbon monoxide poisoning came from the negligence, and they reach that conclusion, I'm not sure how you could ever escape the requirement that a superseding cause relieve you of any responsibility in the slightest degree.
If that initial finding were made, Your Honor, that would be a different scenario than what existed in
this case. But you see, that's the point. It could be made. We don't know. There's no interrogatories to this jury. The judge doesn't make the conclusion. As this is presented to the jury itself, they could make that finding.
They made a finding that there was no negligent design in this case. That was the jury's finding.
How do you know that?
Because that was the jury verdict form.
Well,
that was returned in this case. So, absent, what I would say is Judge Stout made a determination that reasonable minds could differ. He submitted this to the jury. The question is whether or not it was appropriate to submit this to the jury, whether or not there was more than a scintilla of evidence to justify giving this charge to the jury and letting the jury deliberate on the issue. And there's no evidence of an abuse of discretion in his decision doing that.
Can I ask one additional question? Sorry.
I guess what I was trying to get at was this. I thought the way you defended this case was that, first, you weren't negligent, but if the jury somehow believed you were negligent, it was not a proximate cause at all of the accident. Well, that's different than a superseding cause, isn't it?
Not if we can introduce the evidence to explain what caused the event and demonstrate that any finding that we were negligent in no way, not in the slightest way, contributed to that.
Well, really, all you want is an instruction that we're not the if you don't find that we're the proximate cause, then we're not liable. Isn't that what you want?
And we got that. And we got that, Your Honor.
But then you got more than that. You got the superseding instruction.
Well, we got that in the event the jury made a determination that state was negligent.
And was a cause.
And was a cause. Then they had, then they'd make the determination as to whether or not that cause in the slightest way contributed to the happening of the plaintiff's injury.
So what is the evidence, if the jury found that way, that somebody else's negligence completely supplanted any negligence that you had, any cause that caused this accident?
The evidence that supported that was the improper installation of a gas-fired water heater in an apartment that was designed for electric water heaters, the absence of any maintenance for 8 years, the improper installation of the temperature and pressure relief valve so that nobody would know whether or not it was discharging water, the consumption of 4,500 gallons of water over the course of 3 days, the consumption of 2,600 cubic feet of natural gas over the course of 3 days, far exceeding the normal expectation of what would this water heater would consume, evidencing the fact it was running continuously in an unforeseeable way, the installation of new carpet that sealed up any ability to have air return into the room where the water heater was installed and needed a flow of combustible air in order to make sure carbon monoxide was not.
And in other words, the mere existence of carbon monoxide, assuming that's a problem or a defect, is not in any way connected to the injury the plaintiff sustained because the negligence of but for the negligence of others, all that carbon monoxide would have been evacuated and you wouldn't have had the injury.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, your time expired seven
yes.
minutes ago.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Welcome to Virginia, anyway. Ms. Tate, given the nature of the excess time, we're going to put that clock on 4 minutes, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The bedrock of superseding cause is that non-party cause evidence is not admissible unless there is more than a scintilla of evidence that evidence totally severs causation for the conduct of the defendant in the case.
Well, with the last dialogue that your opposing counsel had focused on negligence, but this is a products liability case.
It's
not required to show negligence. You can have a mercantility breach. You can have a design flaw that creates a danger, but the danger is exacerbated in a way that is unforeseeable and not evidence of the original manufacturer's estimation, particularly in this installation manual. And the question is not, it's not a concurring negligence case, which is what I hear your argument to be suggesting. It is a products liability case. So it could have been a design flaw in part, couldn't it? And then a superseding cause is the exacerbation of that flaw beyond reasonable foreseeability.
Justice Kelsey, no. It's not concurring in the sense that everybody can be brought in this case because the non-party causation evidence is not there. Was it foreseeable? Absolutely.
But that's the jury's decision.
No, Your Honor. Under these circumstances, reasonable minds cannot differ that the open exhaust was a proximate cause.
Well, there's no doubt it was a proximate cause. The question is, I mean, the machine is designed to emit carbon monoxide. The question is the expansion of that into the living space. And now their argument is the superseding cause was the cause that caused the expansion in the living space was contrary to their instructions and not reasonably foreseeable. Couldn't a jury conclude, yeah, I agree with that?
No, Justice Kelsey, because if we all agree that the design was a proximate cause, then reversal and final judgment. Because in order to bring in this additional evidence, they have to show that they are totally exonerated, their conduct is exonerated, and that some other causal factor is the sole proximate cause. That's why they don't meet the scintilla test. They had nobody to say that the other conduct, the maintenance, the TP valve going off prematurely.
That's the conclusion of the superseding cause. But going back to Justice Millett's questions, you don't get the superseding cause analytically unless there is a liable, potentially liable defendant, which is duty, breach, and causation.
Exactly. And in a products case, Justice Kelsey, we do have negligence because the design defect portion of the case is a negligence case.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a question about that. I mean, we're all assuming, I think, that the defect was the release of carbon monoxide. Okay. But there was a lot of information about this particular unit. How do we know that the jury, under a superseding thing, that the negligence, it was the release of the carbon monoxide? The negligence could have been another part of the design of that unit, the TP valve or some things like that. We're all assuming that the negligence was the release of carbon monoxide. But we don't know that the jury would have found that in order for a superseding cause.
All the experts agreed that none of the other factors alone could have caused the emission of carbon monoxide or produced the carbon monoxide alone.
But that's my point. A part of that unit could have been defective, but the unit was designed to release carbon dioxide. So that isn't necessarily the negligence. The negligence could have been, or the improper design could have been something else.
Not in this case. The expert testimony was specific that you require oxygen, air for clean combustion. When you have unclean combustion, you get carbon monoxide, which is poisonous. In this case, it was an open vent in the presence of three models that were sealed exhaust. The fact of the open vent heater permitted the carbon monoxide to be emitted into the living space, a proximate cause. End of story for this defendant. The other represented causes, not a single witness said the TP valve opening prematurely caused the emission of carbon monoxide.
I'm saying that the TP valve opened prematurely could have been the negligent design, or it could have been the defect in the design.
But
that was my point.
I apologize. The plaintiff never alleged another defect. The only alleged defect is the open exhaust in the presence of state-of-the-art sealed exhaust. And I think it's clear that that was a cause of these injuries. The other fault, all the other fault, did not get a heads up or yes, that is the sole cause from a single witness. On the issue of foreseeability, Mr. Adams, Mr. Keel, and Mr. Eberhardt all said, we expect the air handler, the big blower, to be situated right beside this heater. It's expected, it's common, and Mr. Adams said that air handler was eating or sucking, I'm not sure the term he used, it was something of that sort, was sucking all the air away from this heater. And the end of the story is the unsealed exhaust was eating that. And reasonable minds cannot differ that that was a cause. You cannot send all this to a jury to decide all of it because they're not entitled to have it considered when the other parties are not present. And that's the reason for the rule.
Well, it seems like to me what you're saying, Ms. Tate, is you should have prevailed as a matter of law.
I believe I should have.
Okay.
And I said that in post-trial motions.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you, both sides, for good arguments. Call the next case.